Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Greetings and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher. I'm also known as the Food Healer. And we've got a beautiful day in Brooklyn today, and I'm hoping everybody else is getting this gorgeous spring day. And we've got a really cool episode. I've got Nancy Scazzeri back. Last time she was here, we were talking about a documentary that she was working on, and it's being released. So we're going to get you all the details. Just get comfy, and we're going to get started. So, Nancy, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Celia. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, good to hear you, too.
You've been busy, huh?
Yes. Yeah. We finished the film, finally.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
So, I'm really excited to be talking with you, especially because, like, you finished everything. Like, last time we were talking, you were working so hard on this and getting all your fundraising and stuff. So, now what's right. happening?
Well, we finished a festival cut, and we finished a TV cut, and it'll be going out on PBS stations on Memorial Day.
Cool.
End of May. So I'm not sure which ones are going to pick it up, but we hope it'll have a good distribution through PBS.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, it's really good. And it's playing at the Manhattan Film Festival on the 26th of April,
and
1 p.m.
Are you doing one showing there, or is it going to be there for a time?
Yeah, just one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that again and remind everybody, since we're in Brooklyn here, so a lot of people listening are in the city, so that we can get them in there.
Okay.
So what's the official name of the documentary?
The name of the documentary is Canine Soldiers, The Militarization of Love. And we added that last part to the title. It was originally called Canine Soldiers, but mm-hmm. it turned out to be more and more about this use of love that we have between ourselves and dogs and canines, and how that is used in a war situation. And, you know, for better or for worse, mm-hmm. there's repercussions to that. But it does actually happen. There's a terrific love bond established between the handler and the dog. And in order to be a successful team, you absolutely need that bond of love for the dog to perform this incredible, important duty of finding improvised explosive devices before they detonate and kill soldiers.
Yeah, so for people that have no idea what we're talking about, basically, Nancy's been researching, and please correct me if I'm wrong, she's been researching dogs in the military for quite a while now, and so the different jobs and things like that. So are you being specific on, are you doing like all military dogs, or are you like sticking to like one job that they have in the movie?
Right. The movie really looks at two types of dogs that the military uses in today's wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. They are dual-purpose dogs that are trained to detect bombs, and also dogs that are used to attack. So you have a dual-purpose dog, and they tend to be the German Shepherds or Belgian Malinois. And then you have another dog, an SSD dog, that's just trained to find explosives, and they will range from all varieties of species and dogs, from Labradors to German short-haired pointers, mm-hmm. and, you know, just dogs that are easy to train and have a high-drive instinct to find prey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So from you guys releasing this to you starting it, how long have you been working on this film?
Oh, gosh. Well, there were a lot of starts and stops because three out of the four characters that I was following, three out of four dropped away. Nothing to do with the film, but because they weren't going to deploy or they were re-enlisted in another job. Mm-hmm. So it took a while, and it was a lot of stops and starts and lots of obstacles. The military changed their mind at one point.
Oh, wow.
But finally we finished it, and yeah, it's done.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
You know, that's so funny that this shows you how little I know about filmmaking. It never would have crossed my mind that you had to get permission from the military to do this. But obviously, I mean, you need film footage of this, you know.
Right. Yeah, they gave permission because it came through our local PBS station. They will entertain projects that have a distribution in place, and so they considered our PBS station, you know, that it would be have enough of an audience to make it worth their while to stop what they were doing and give interviews and allow me to, you know, observe their training of their dog. So, yeah.
And so I'm assuming just because it's the military, I'm assuming that it was like super high security and things like that. Like, was it a really, I don't know, full of paperwork kind of experience?
Right. Well, I'm based in Austin, Texas, and we are sandwiched between two of the largest military bases in the free world.
Oh, wow.
Austin's supposed to be this really cool, hip town, and we're actually just an hour away from the largest military base, Fort Hood, that's the size of Rhode Island. And then south of here in San Antonio, we have Lackland Air Force Base, which is the largest training facility for military working dogs. And so they were very kind. They allowed us to come down and film some of their training and talk to various people connected with the dog training program. And when my time had finished there, I was then able to, obstacles started coming my way and I started losing three of the four handlers, I was able to go to Fort Hood and pick up another story there of a female handler and her dog and spend more time in Fort Hood. And they were incredibly welcoming and it was really, really great to be
That's
able to
really
go
cool.
freely back and forth. Yeah.
Nice. And so how long is the film?
The film is 56 minutes for television. It's 56 minutes. There's a slightly longer version of an hour and 6 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool.
I think the shorter one that's playing at the film festival is better. It's often the case where you can say the same thing in less time and
totally.
It moves faster. So, yeah.
And so from beginning to end, how many dogs did you film? How many dogs did you study, really?
Oh, that's a good question. There are two main dogs in the film, Dex and Block, that belong to the two handlers that sort of sustain the story. One deploys to Afghanistan with his dog, Dex, who is a golden retriever.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually see him in training, on deployment, in a firefight,
wow.
and on his return home,
wow.
and having to give his dog up at the very end. The other handler, Danielle Jennings, is a sergeant who you see at the beginning of the film. She talks a little bit about how the dog changed her personality. She was very uptight.
Mm-hmm.
She was all about military and proving herself and always doing things perfectly and, you know, within just always. She had to be a perfectionist, she describes her personality. And then the dog, that doesn't work with a dog to be
yeah,
like
seriously.
That. So she had to learn how to play, and this dog actually changed her.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, but she describes going to three deployments with two different dogs. And her outcome, which I won't tell you in the film, is something that happened over the process of making the film. So
oh,
the
wow.
end of the film, the second half of the film, is I didn't know that it was going to head in that direction. So it takes the process of making a documentary and, of course, being open to the flow. If you can sustain something over that length of time, things change, things happen to dogs, they change, and we're able to capture some of that in the film.
Yeah, it's a good point with documentaries, because it's not like, I mean, you guys go and you obviously have an idea of what you do, you know, and you obviously, like, script out ideal scenes that you'd like to have and stuff, but it's, you know, yeah, it's not like a Hollywood movie where it's like, we're going to have you from the beginning to the end, you know. It's a really, really interesting point.
Right. Yes, and it's really thanks to the editor, Michelle Naimé, who worked on this, and oh my gosh, you know, you need to have a really good editor who's also got the patience and perseverance to keep working with footage, and eventually, you know, we did the best we could with what we had.
Nice.
You know.
So is it being submitted to any other film festivals?
It actually actually premiered in the Austin Film Festival.
Awesome.
We've submitted it to a few others waiting to hear, and hopefully we'll go to a few other festivals with it. It's always good to go to festivals. I used to think, oh, television's enough. That's fine. You know, lots and lots of people, thousands of people will see it. Mm-hmm. That's great. But film festivals are really good. They're both good for the filmmaker and for the audience because there's a real reciprocal experience there, and you feel it. And if you have been working in isolation for 4 years,
wow,
then it makes the personal connection with an audience makes it worthwhile. It's gratifying.
And I can't even imagine, especially, you know, it's really, I mean, you're sitting here working on something with all your heart and soul. And like, I mean, when we were talking last time and you're trying to get the fundraising, getting this finished, you know, it was just every day you're living this film. And so what an honor to be able to submit it to a bunch of people in a forum and, you know, get feedback from it and also hear responses that are what you were hoping for, you know?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, you everybody thinks about their role in the film, and of course mine's important, but without the co-producer, Christina Mann, who was there for every grant that we wrote, who co-wrote and rewrote stuff over and over that we had to submit for, you know, $3,000 here or $8,000 there, whatever, and many grants we didn't get, but it was just this continuous persistence of trying, and I couldn't have done it alone. So I'm really grateful for the team effort. And, you know, the film is about a dog and a handler. They couldn't do what they do without each other. So
It just sounds, I mean, I'm just so excited about this for you, especially because when we were first talking about it, for people that have missed that episode and haven't heard it, I mean, how many branches of the military use dogs?
Certainly the infantry uses dogs, soldiers on the ground, boots on the ground. As you know, the Navy SEALs used a dog named Cairo in the capture of Osama bin Laden.
Oh, yeah.
Capture and killing of Osama bin Laden. And that dog must have been incredible. She did not make a peep the
really?
Whole time they were involved in that mission.
Wow.
And I don't know exactly what role the dog played. They still haven't really released information about the dog's exact behavior. So it's all mystery.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, is the amount of training they go through is amazing.
Yes, yes, yes. Wow.
And so what prompted you to make this film?
I finished a film called Tattooed Under Fire. It was about the effect of war on soldiers before they go and the kind of tattoos they put on their bodies in anticipation of war. And then when they come back and have had certain experiences, they make another kind of tattoo on their body. And so it's coming from a dark place of the unconscious, and the images can be extraordinary.
Uh-huh.
What manifested. Anyway, and that's when I heard about these dogs. And at the time, we really weren't paying attention to these wars very much. And soldiers were being killed, and thousands of civilians were being killed in Iraq. And so I felt like, well, maybe maybe we care so much about our dogs that will be a good way to talk about war. And so that was kind of an impetus. But then when I got started, I learned a lot more about dogs and humans, and found it really fascinating that we have been relying on dogs for thousands of years to lead us through all kinds of situations.
Wow.
And they even lead us in our dream life. They're a big part of our cultural mythology. The Egyptians had them, the Romans, the Greeks, the Aztecs, I mean, you name it.
Wow.
There's always been a dog in our mythology leading our souls to the other side. We sort of need dogs to be ahead of us.
That's
leading
wild.
Us, you know, to the afterlife.
Yep.
in some cases. And then in the hunt, I mean, they've allowed us to get ahead as a species.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by helping us hunt and warning us of an enemy or danger on the other side. So we've we have in the film, we have a couple of experts, Mark Beckhoff and Temple Grandin, who talk about the coevolution that has happened with dogs emotionally, mm-hmm. so that parts of our brains have actually coevolved in a certain way where we feel the same things in the same parts of our brain. And dogs, as you know, probably they scan our faces left to right. And humans do that when we look at each other. We look at each other from left to right. So there's a lot of things we have in common.
That's wild. That's so cool. And it's, I mean, for someone, it's funny, when I was coming to the show today, I was actually in another section of Brooklyn, and I was walking down the sidewalk, and there was this, like, ancient Chihuahua mutt, basically. It was all arthritic and kind of staggering down the street, and there's a rescue on the corner, and I was like, oh, no, don't tell me this poor dog is abandoned or, you know, lost or something.
Uh-huh.
And no, it was this guy's dog, and he walked out of his shop, and this dog was hysterical. And, it, like, the bond that these two had was... besides the fact that it was just charming and adorable, you know, you when you see a person with their dog and they've really got that connection, I mean, it's a partnership, and it really, it's not a person and a dog. It's like two souls communicating, really.
Right. Yeah.
It's just so funny.
It is.
Well, we need to take a quick break for station identification. I'm talking to Nancy Scazzeri all about her movie Canine Soldiers, so stay tuned. We'll be back in about a minute and a half.
I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
And I'm back, talking to Nancy Scazzeri all about her movie Canine Soldiers, which is being released soon, and it's going to be playing in Manhattan. So can you tell us again, Nancy, the theater and the date and time?
Oh, great. I don't know the name of the theater. In the Manhattan Film Festival. So if you go to their website, MFF, Manhattan Film Festival. It's on 22nd East 22nd Street, or it's just north of NYU in that area. And it'll be playing at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, the 26th of April.
Cool. I want to go. I'm hoping to have the day off so I can actually go and see this. I'm dying to see this movie. I'm so excited about it for you guys.
Awesome.
And so, when you were doing this, what was the biggest surprise you had when you were researching for this film?
The biggest surprise I came up back with was how dogs come down with PTSD very much like soldiers do, and from the same situations. And I really thought, I didn't think that they would be that sensitive to, the experiences of war. Mm. And they do. They come back, and they're actually more sensitive, possibly, than humans, because they have fewer filters. They're more sensitive to sound than we are, and to smell, and even possibly emotionally. So they possibly suffer more than humans do.
Wow.
With the kind of PTSD that they get.
And so how does that manifest in a dog?
Oh, the dog shows behavior. It can't tolerate loud noise. It shrinks away. It runs away. It stops interacting with people, becomes very withdrawn, or has anger management problems. They call when soldiers come back and they react violently in situations. Well, so do dogs. Dogs come back with incredibly aggressive behavior, and no one can handle them anymore.
Wow.
They maul and they bite, and they have to be put down.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But the symptoms are similar, though, to people as well, with the whole, like, distancing yourself and, you know, not being able to deal with loud noises and all that kind of thing. It's so similar, too.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, you've had soldiers describe being in a supermarket or any kind of situation, and there'll be a loud noise, and they freak out.
Mm. And what was your favorite moment when you were doing this?
It's funny. It kind of comes to, towards the end of the film with the dog, a puppy, a young dog, Belgian Malinois.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the handlers is given this dog for adoption because she's not able to be in the military anymore because of PTSD. So she's given a dog. And this dog is also a military reject. It was a dog bred in the Lackland Puppy Program. I mean, they breed dogs. They'll breed dogs that have the most extrovert personalities or mm-hmm. The least fear of gunfire. They try and breed dogs that are going to be perfect in war.
Mm-hmm.
And this one backfired, as often many do. So this one comes home to her, and she hands it a toy. And she says, you know, the problem with this dog is it doesn't care about the toys that they give them when they're rewarded for finding a bomb.
Okay.
And so she puts it in its mouth, and it just drops it. it's a moment in the film where everybody laughs. She says, as you can see, it could care less about the toys that are to use. Oh.
So did you have any did you wind up having any fondnesses for any of the specific dogs in the movie?
There's a dog in the movie, yeah, that comes back with PTSD, and I'm yeah, partial to that dog. And yeah, that one's very sweet. I mean, I didn't really get to handle the dog, so in fact, the closest I've come to one was after the movie, and someone in the street was walking along with this Belgian Malinois, and I stopped, and I said, is this dog a military working dog? And they go, yes, it was trained at Lackland, but I've adopted it. And this dog came right up to me and came up to the side and looked me in the eyes, just like the dogs in the film look at their handlers. And it was the first experience I had of this dog,
wow.
You know, really giving me this, its full attention, and mm-hmm. I was like, wow, what a thrill.
It's really wild. I mean, it's especially with like highly trained dogs, because it's almost whenever I'm around them, I'm always kind of like, are you psychic? Like, I just feel like they just know too much. You know, they're so, so smart. And those eyes, too, are kind of they go right through you, you know?
Right. Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Well, I really have so much respect for you and your crew for doing this, because I think one of the problems that's going on right now is that there's so much violence out there that all of us are becoming very good at shutting down towards it and kind of looking away. And I think what's happening, especially with these dogs, I think this is a really important film to get this information out, because, I mean, before I spoke to you for the first time, I had no idea what these guys did or how many were involved or, you know, anything like this.
Uh-huh.
And so to hear that, you know, we actually have a species that's not us helping us and going to war and, uh-huh. you know, working together is it's just amazing to me. And I thank you so much for taking the time to do this, because...
Right.
Thank I think
you,
it's important.
Yeah,
that
you're right.
Know
it's
it.
Absolutely a way to realize how much we have in common with other species and how much we owe them, whether they're protecting us or whether we eat them in the food chain. I mean, we owe them so much.
Yeah, we do.
And this war, these wars, dogs. These dogs are saving about 150 lives during their military career. That's what
wow.
they've estimated.
Wow. It's
pretty impressive. Yeah.
God, that's enormous. And so is there ever, like, with these working dogs, is it always one-on-one, or, like, when they're done for the day and or when they get a chance to, like, relax, are they social to other people, or is it kind of like, that person's my person and I don't deal with anybody else in this room?
That's a good question, because in World War II, they did train dogs to be one-on-one dogs. And when they were finished with that handler, they couldn't move on to another handler, or really sometimes couldn't even come home. But now the dogs are trained, and they can move on from one handler to another.
Cool.
But some of the handlers in the film raised this question, is it fair that a dog has been deployed, it's done its duty, let it come home and just be a dog, at least for the last few years of its life.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as the dog is willing to work and doesn't show signs of PTSD, the dog will redeploy for probably 10 years of its life, and then it will be too tired and retire, and it comes home, and it has about 1 or 2 years left of its life just to be a dog.
Wow.
So there's the handlers in the film, makes a point against that. That that's not fair. You know, they should be treated like soldiers. They've done their time.
Mm-hmm.
They should be able to come back and live a life.
I got to tell you, I agree with that, because in a dog's lifespan, I mean, let's take a dog that lives 15 years. If they're in the military for 10, I mean, that's the same as people being in from, like, oh, my God, 18 to what, like 70 or 80? I mean, wow.
Yeah. That's right.
That's a long time.
That's right. Sergeant Jenny, in fact, that's exactly a point that one of the handlers makes in the film. She calculates it by human years.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. It's like, wow. That's really wild. Well, is there anything that you would like our listeners to know about canine soldiers and anything about that?
Oh, well, just thank you for taking the interest in it and for having this amazing radio show that you have that looks at food and animals and all kinds of things that are so important to us all and deserve this attention. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nancy. I mean, thank you for keeping
me. Glad you do what you do.
I'm glad you do what you do. And thank you so much for contacting me about this. When I first got your email that you finished the movie, I was so excited for you. I was like, yes, she did it. And so, with some luck, I will be there at the screening on Wednesday, the 26th at 1 p.m. Really, really looking forward to it. And are you going to be there?
Oh, yes. And thank you so much. I'm so excited to meet you, Celia.
I'm dying.
Really,
I'm going to have to call in sick to work. I need to put this in my calendar. I don't feel very well.
That's great.
Yay. Well, Nancy, thank you again. What's the website that people can get, like the trailer and all that good stuff for this?
Yeah. It's called caninesoldiersfilm.com. It's all one word, caninesoldiers with an S, film.com.
Perfect. And so, yeah, if any of y'all are interested, if you're in the New York area, come. It'll be fun. It'll be nice to meet some listeners. It'll be really cool to meet Nancy. I mean, I'm psyched. And, yeah, we can all, like, I don't know, go get a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or beer afterwards.
I think
you deserve a cocktail.
With happy hour drinks all day with the ticket stub, and we're going to all go for a drink afterwards. So please
all
join
right,
us.
Let's do it. That sounds great. So, Nancy, thank you again. I will see you on the 26th. For everybody else, join us. Come to the movie.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I will talk to you soon. Everybody else, I got a new episode next week. I am looking forward to it. And then we go on a little tiny vacation for like a week or two. No big deal. In that time, if you really miss me, you can always go to iTunes or Stitcher to Animal Instinct Radio, and you can find me there. And until then, I hope you guys have a great week. Enjoy the spring weather and take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.